Welcome back to another edition of the Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill. It's me, Len Testa, and this is our show for the week of Schmursday, March 11th, 2024. On the show today, special guest Christina Harrison tells us what's good at Epcot's Flower and Garden Festival. And in listener questions, y'all have 8 bajillion hacks for Disney's upcoming free water park admission feature. Then in our main segment, Jim walks us through part of the last huge Magic Kingdom transformation project when Disney proposed Pixie Hollow for Fantasyland, and we ended up with Storybook Circus. Let's get started by bringing in the man who wants to know why weighted blankets only come in one color, best described as mental illness gray. It's Mr. Jim Hill. Jim, how's it going?
It's going well, Len, but here's what I don't understand. Weighted blanket equals good. Wet blanket equals bad. But they basically weigh the same, right?
Yeah, why does a weighted blanket not as good? Yeah, interesting. It's all about context, Jim.
I guess so. And do you, in fact, use a weighted blanket? Because Nancy does, sort of. She climbs into bed, she pulls up the cover, and then our 8-foot-long, 1,500-pound house cat Ginger climbs on top of her and effectively pins her down under the covers.
Jim, it's called budgeting. Ah. I mean, just let her do her thing.
Okay. All right. And again, just to be clear here, I don't know if Ginger actually weighs 1,500 pounds. It just feels like that when she steps on my bladder at 3 a.m. But anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Also with us today is Touring Plans Walt Disney World in-park researcher, taste tester, and newly minted Fort Wilderness camping enthusiast, Christina Harrison. Christy, how's it going?
Too soon. Hi. Hello. Just talking about the weighted blankets, I'm over here having like a panic attack. I don't understand.
The exact opposite of what we intended.
And I'm going to go change my shirt.
Here we go. All right, before we get started, let's do a quick shout out. Thanks to everyone who subscribes to the show over at patreon.com/JimHillMedia, including Alex Jacobs, Michael Marufi, Greg DiMichilli, John Kivas, Chris Jesperson, and Sue Moore. Jim, these are the Disney cast members trying to replicate the beef fat candle on Le Cellier's charcuterie board at other World Showcase restaurants. They say the bratwurst candle at Beer Garden is a qualified success. The foie gras candle at Chefs de France is a hit, and it's back to the drawing board at Norway after the Scent of Trolls fiasco. Sue says she told you so. True story.
I would buy all of those. I'm going to eat all of them.
I don't know. Trolls lurking under bridges. No, bad smell.
I was at a private tequila event last week, and Sebastian from La Cava was there, and he smelled good. And I was like, what are you wearing? He's like, oh, it's the scent that you get in the Norway Pavilion after the ride. And now I'm like, I got to go get that. All right, on to the news. The news is sponsored by touringplans.com. Touring Plans helps you save time and money at theme parks like Walt Disney World. Check us out at touringplans.com. All right, we talked about it last week briefly, but Universal Orlando has released more information last week about updates to its kid-friendly Shrek and Trolls lands at Universal Studios Florida. Remember, this update is where, Jim, the old Woody Woodpecker land used to be, I think?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm.
All right. And so Universal says that this is what we're getting. In the Shrek area, we're getting Shrek's Swamp Meet, where you get to meet Shrek, Princess Fiona, Donkey, and so on, outside of Shrek's cottage. That should be interesting. We get a water play area called Shrek's Swamp for Little Ogres. I'm not sure what this is. Mama Luna Feline Fiesta? Jim, you're the cat person here.
Well, yes, this is actually from the Puss in Boots 2, The Last Wish, the feature that came out late last year or thereabouts. And this is the retirement home that Puss in Boots temporarily went to in that film, which was filled with way too many cats. And from the description here, it looks like this is more of a hands-on interactive thing where you're going to, for lack of a better term, you get the chance to herd cats, Len, and you know that you know, in this retirement home. And if you're good at your job, you may actually get to spot Puss in Boots as you are moving these cats around the screen.
Oh, fantastic. All right, so it's interactive video?
Yes. Yeah, stationed within the Shrek Swamp area.
And then the other interactive thing is King Harold's Swamp Symphony, which I guess it said something about stomping on lily pads.
Well, yeah, thanks to our buddy BioReconstruct, who's done a flyover of this. What's interesting is you have sort of the stone wall with these frogs seated on the wall, and then these lily pads on the ground directly below them. And little kids are supposed to run up and jump on the lily pad, which then causes the frog on the stone wall to open its mouth and sing. And as you jump back and forth from lily pad to lily pad, you can get, you know, sort of a harmonized chorus, so to speak.
I can't wait for these samples to show up on YouTube as music videos.
There we go.
And then there's an eatery. I guess it's a kiosk called Swamp Snacks. I'm kind of surprised that Gatorland doesn't already have something named this. But okay.
Okay.
But you get a Shrexel, which is a Shrek-shaped pretzel.
Mm-hmm.
Far, far a waffle and frozen ogre, which I like.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then the trolls area. Chrissy, jump in here if any of this sounds appealing to Gigi.
Mm-hmm. I'm down for all of it.
The big one in the trolls land is the Troller Coaster. They did take my advice on the name. I think I actually knew what it was named ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a family-friendly coaster involving spiders. I'm not sure that the words family-friendly and spiders belong in the same sentence, but okay.
But they're spiders from the Trollerverse, so they're cute. You know, they're stylized. They very little venom.
Very little, practically none.
Practically none. <Okay. laughs>
And then Poppy's Playground, which is, I guess, a mushroom-covered shaded play area. All right. This kind of reminds me of the old Honey, I Shrunk the Kids movie set adventure. Troll Sheets, which is food. High Five Hideaway, which is a retail location. And then we get to the Kung Fu Panda area, which, Jim, we didn't talk about. But what's going here?
Well, what's kind of interesting is that, and again, everything we've talked about so far, with the exception of the Shrek's Cottage, which is a custom-built facility for, the DreamWorks land. They've taken the old Curious George Goes to Town ball play, water play area. And what happens here is you enter the Panda Village, and they've left some of the structure from Curious George in place, but totally rethemed it, that sort of thing. So there will be, like the Mama Luna area, there'll be a digital component where Shrek, Po, the Kung Fu Panda, will come out and attempt to give you kung fu lessons while at the same time he's supposed to be watching his mischievous nephew and or cooking stuff for his adoptive father. And, now what's interesting about this, and I haven't been able to confirm this yet, it appears that these will be pre-recorded video as opposed to actual interactive video, sort of like the, you know, Turtle Talk with Crush. But yeah, I mean, it's this lovely little mini land within, the DreamWorks land that really leans heavily into the aesthetic and the characters for the Kung Fu Panda film series, which, by the way, continues. In fact, this show goes live on Monday the 11th, but on the 8th, the fourth film in the series, Kung Fu Panda 4, bows in theaters.
So, Jim, am I to understand here that in order to be admitted into the training camp, everyone must be kung fu fighting?
That they may. And by the way, I really should have read ahead, because you mentioned here in your notes for the show today that the digital component I just described is listed as Po Live. So, hey, it is interactive. It will be.
There you go.
Turtle Talk Like Crush. So, how cool.
And you mentioned that we're recording the show on Thursday, March 8th, for release on March 11th. And before the show, Jim, you said that we should expect to hear more about Epic Universe's Other Lands any day now, right?
That is the plan.
All right, we'll see what happens.
I would have assumed, I'm curious, the Kung Fu Panda stuff. Have you seen the movie, Leonard? The first one?
I've seen the highlights of it. I don't recall the entire thing, but
I'm assuming that the whole area is themed around like the crushing weight of parental expectations, and then it's like eating contests, like steam buns. You got to watch the movie.
I'm 100% in there. Yes.
Yeah, I'm ready. I'm ready for all of it.
And by the way, that March 11th thing, folks, technically, what's the phrase for that, Len? Foreshadowing?
Foreshadowing.
Foreshadowing. Yes. Okay.
The other big event that started last week, Flower and Garden 2024. And I was there on opening day with Christina and a bunch of other people, and we got to do a whole bunch of fun things. So, Christina, why don't you walk us through what you have experienced at this year's Flower and Garden, what you think is the best, and what you think people should avoid.
Okay. And we should say, we should go back to what you said earlier, quick caveat, that I was the only sober one on the team. Stone
That's because
cold
I had to do a 10 o'clock tequila tasting.
Had to. Must. Was required.
Yes.
You drank. Yeah. You're welcome tequila. You're tasting tequila. You're parting agave, whatever it was.
And there, there were six shots of tequila, a margarita, some mezcal, and of course, vodka as a palate cleanser. It's like they could see inside my soul.
It's the equivalent of sniffing the coffee beans when you're checking out really fancy perfume with Gigi. But yeah, Javier and Sebastian and Cowboy Ricky and Umberto and everybody made sure that the whole rest of the team was completely intoxicated. So honestly, nobody should listen to anything the rest of you guys say. It should just be me. Because I was stone cold sober. I had
I was walking out of there going, this is the single greatest event in the history of Disney World.
You literally stayed longer than any other festival in the history
I stayed festival. I stayed until after
just
dark.
You were drunk. You were like chilling. Anyway,
and then I Ubered that day too. I Ubered that day.
Yeah, well, so, and then I had to drive you home. So yeah.
That's right.
Okay. So I know you have opinions, but nobody cares because they're drunk opinions. All right. So Flower and Garden, very clearly the best festival for several reasons. Number one, we are not eating soup in August at Food and Wine. Food and Wine is lovely, but it's too hot. The earth is burning and we hate everything. Okay.
Yeah. The last thing we want is a steaming hot cup of cheddar cheese soup when it's 105 outside.
I mean, it's delicious and all, but you're just trying not to pass out. But this festival, this is how Florida tricks you is this time of year. You're like, the weather is so gorgeous. Oh, my gosh. If I was back home in Minnesota, it would be 16 degrees.
Yeah.
Or, oh, it's snowing at home. And look at me. It's how they get you. Anyway, yes. So topiaries are gorgeous. It makes you feel like you can garden. You cannot. Just look at
these. Not to that level of skill. Did I see something about Disney adding projection mapping to some of the topiaries?
Yes, the one in Mexico. Oh, also they're making some changes too. There's a little cute. I don't know if I'm allowed to give it away. Sebastian showed us a little preview of some things that they're doing at the booth in Mexico. But yes, in Mexico, where the cocoa topiary is. So if you're standing at the kitchen and you're facing the Odyssey, you'll see it.
Oh,
well, I'll get
nice.
You some nighttime stuff because I'm there all weekend camping, as you alluded to. Okay.
Oh, cool. So if you get the photos, I'll throw them in the show notes.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, that's smart.
What else is good? Okay, what else besides topiaries?
Topiaries, there are two scavenger hunts. There's the standard, the pollination, spike the bee, you know, that you're looking for. And the prizes this year are so great. They're these mini cornhole games that actually work. They're so well done. And it's the first prize that we've had post-COVID, in my opinion, that is not junk. Ah, I hate to say it, but they've been like so cheaply done. Like we've just thrown them together, but this is like, it's painted nicely. I know it's not hand painted, but they're adorable. There's four of them and they have the two little bean bags. So great. We've come up with, cornhole teams. My team is the Corn Stars. Anyway. So there are really great prizes. And then the prizes for the extravaganza are so adorable. They're six little charms. So that runs just through April 9th or until supplies last. And they say that because it always runs out. Typically, it's some sort of Easter egg. So that's the eggs that you see. Then you'll see Spike the Bee. But the charms, they're so precious. They're these little enamel charms. They come on the like a little white ribbon. And the you can redeem them when you get the map if you want. They're $9.99 plus tax, so $8.51 after tax and your discount each, and you get one prize per map. Anyway, on the back of the charm, there's this little, I don't know if you're familiar with Roberto coin jewelry, but there's a ruby on the back of every piece that they make, and the ruby is supposed to go next to your skin, you know, blah, blah. Anyway, it's romantic and lovely and sweet, but there's a little charm just like that on the back of each one of these, a really nice little touch. So worth money. Okay. So you have two scavenger hunts, keeps the kids busy. And then on the weekends, I was so excited to see this. Uncrustables is sponsoring a garden and it's right near the Figment statue. So it's on that walkway. If you're walking from World Celebration to World Showcase, it's on your left. And like they're
right down, right down the middle of Main Street, USA.
Right down the middle. Yeah. Free Uncrustables.
Okay.
Strawberry and grape. They are frozen, which everybody knows that's the best way to eat them.
Oh, yeah. That's the way to eat them. Yeah.
So they were so sweet. The lovely cast members handing them out. So Uncrustables, mm-hmm. I don't know if they bought like 50 bajillion cases or whatever, but everybody was so excited because, you know, it's like $6.75 for the Uncrustables meal at Sunshine Seasons. And yeah, my kid mm-hmm. doesn't like them or husband mm-hmm. or whatever. So if you ask them, you know, they'll hand you one. You want grape or strawberry? If you ask for one of each, they'll give you one of each. Or they did last weekend. So lovely. Love a freebie.
This is the best Disney dining plan tip I've heard so far.
Oh, just you wait, buddy. Just you wait. Okay, I got some good stuff coming because we're testing out. Not only are we testing out the resilience of the human spirit, my ability to deal with Florida nature and
Gigi. You're camping. Yeah.
In a tent.
Mm-hmm. In a tent.
No, we're doing that, but we're also testing out quick service dining. And I really think that we've got some good things, but I'll tell you about that when it's all done. Okay. And then besides the fact that the festival smells amazing, if you are, you know, your allergies under control, you've got your flu nays or whatever, just the most gorgeous. Oh, so stunning. And it's nice that they moved the festival up a little bit because towards the end, every other year, those hydrangeas. Is bad.
Yeah, looking a little rough. Yeah,
it's like when the lights come on at the club. Yeah, it's not cute. Okay.
Yeah.
Then there's it's only like little touches that make me just love this festival. There's the tea tour in the UK pavilion. It is stunning back there. Stunning. I don't know the right way to say it. Okay.
Oh, but yeah, because they do. We walked through here, but we walked through backwards. Yeah, it was fantastic. Free. Yeah.
So they have the lovely teacups, and then they tell you all about the different kinds of tea,
right?
You know what, especially the florals, which are my favorite. But you can go into the tea caddy, and you can get your guide for free. You can do self guided, or you can do the guided tour, all free. And at the end, you get a lovely little sealed tea bag, which I know that's not much, but we'll take what we can get. It's just nice to have the little token. It's sweet.
Yeah.
Okay. Then we have the Garden Graze, which is just like the cookie stroll. Where you have 8 items to choose from, you need 5 stamps. So you hand them your festival passport.
This is one of the last things you and I did when we were there together.
Yeah. And then the prize is a collectible plastic flower and garden cup with your Dole Whip. You can get it empty if you want. You don't have to have the Dole Whip sundae. And then a pack of wildflower seeds, which actually do grow. It's very sweet. And on brand. Yeah. So all the extras and stuff are really nice. Plus the weather is lovely and you're not blacking out.
Yeah. I mean, it's supposed to be like 80 this weekend.
I've been stalking it pretty hard because again, basically sleeping in the dirt. I have an air mattress. And so I've been tracking everything because I don't care. Like I'm too old. Like I have a king size bed with a really wonderful like mattress cover. I'm very particular about everything in my life, but for some reason, Juana's decided, I don't know, her rebellious spirit, whatever. She wants to camp. And this child, we can't go to Tom Sawyer Island any longer because there was once an attack squirrel when she was 6 that gave her bad vibes, air quotes. Mm-hmm. And so she won't go back.
She wants to go camping.
Yes.
This is going to be one of those things that she brings up in therapy for the next 15 years.
It's fine. I keep a journal so that she knows.
Yeah, it's fine. You can actually get the jump on the therapist. You know what? She's going to say this, but let me just
literally
give you my sentence.
I've been journaling since before I started IVF with her because I figured if I had this reference, if you and I had this, we would be better people, but we're not. So you just have to help the next generation.
Listen, learn.
Anyway, So we're camping, but part of our, she wants to spend the entire weekend at Fort Wilderness. Don't understand why she loves it. Cause this chick is very at home at the Grand Wilaya on Maui.
100%. Like, You can spend a weekend at Fort Wilderness. Yeah.
Yeah. Right, so anyway, but we'll be at Flower and Garden cause they haven't tasted all of my favorite dishes. So here's the favorite. Here's ones to avoid. And I know Laurel and I already got into it this morning about the absolutely not. So my favorite booth, overall booth. There's 2, but the main one is the Honey Bistro. Mm-hmm. Not only do you get your little bee antenna, I don't know, is that the right way to say it? Antenna, yeah. Little hat, you know, it looks like the Burger King hat.
Sure.
But for bees on the weekends, they have the chicken and waffles. Now, I miss the stuffing, but the waffle is the stuffing. Anyway, the hot honey sauce, it's not spicy. It's more like a warming effect, sort of.
It is. Oh. That's exactly how I'd say it. It's a warming effect. But the waffle, remember, is a jalapeno cornbread waffle. It's not a sweet waffle.
Right, but we're not going to scare anyone because I'm a spice weenie, and it is not. It's not spicy. It's not any of that. Like,
you were in the Spice Girls.
Which one would I have been? Sleepy.
Spice Weenie.
Spice Weenie. Oh yeah.
Weenie Spice.
All right. I'll work on my costume. Yeah, so it's lovely. It's really nice. Anyone, like, I would give this to our mother and she can't. Like, black olives are too spicy. Okay. So, and then the cauliflower. This is not like, I know everybody poo-poos cauliflower and whatever. It's really, it's lovely. It's grilled and it makes it a little sweeter. So, so good. So
I'll say it was a very generous serving of cauliflower. I think we're asking too much of this vegetable to be, it is not a main dish. It is at best.
It's flour and garden. This is not the meat and cheese festival. Okay. This is flour and garden.
I want to explore this meat and cheese festival idea a little bit more, but maybe on another
sponsored by Pepperidge Farms. Done.
100%. It should be between food and wine and the holiday thing. It's like Meat Fest 2024. Yes.
What's that? Anyway. What's that box cheese that I always give out at the Snapdown? It's
Velveeta.
No, I do love Velveeta. No, is it Hillshire Farms, the Christmas?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Oh, there we go.
Is that what it is? Okay, yeah.
The entire distribution model is based on mall kiosks.
There we go.
That's a really good idea for a between festival, the meat and cheese. Okay.
Okay, so you like the bistro chicken and waffles. I thought, in terms of chicken dish, the best thing was the plant-based buffalo chicken and tater tots. It's plant-based, but it was, I know everything else plant-based was terrible and we'll talk about that. But I thought that was actually the buffalo sauce actually tasted like true buffalo wing sauce, not like, you know, the knockoff version or whatever. The other thing two other points. One, it was a ton of food for like $7. Hmm. And then two, I believe after checking with the chef that the tots were catered in-house, making them more desirable.
Here's the deal though. It's not on the dining plan. So if we're going to go strictly great value, like a good value,
fair,
you have to be able to use a snack credit, and you can't on that one, and you can't on the funnel cake in Merca. So both of those are off the table for me. Also, I'm just over, like, I love a plant-based vegetable is a vegetable, but I don't like when we try to make plants into meat substances, a la Japan, the steam bun. Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. Wanted to throw it, but that's a whole other conversation. Okay.
I mean, so, let me quote Mean Girls here and say, stop trying to make Satan a thing. Jim's just cracking up here.
I'm still appreciating the language of the tots were tatered in house. We had, never mind about.
He was still drunk. He spent all morning getting drunk with Javier at La Cava.
I actually asked one of the chefs in the booth that question. And these tots, are they tatered in-house? And he looked at me like,
that's wonderful language. And more to the point, look, Chrissy, someone had to throw themselves on that guava flavored grenade,
Chrissy kept this moving. I was like, hey, let's stay here and look around. She's like, no, we've got eight places to go. Let's go. Yeah.
Oh my God, could you stop being drunk? We went to
flowers are so pretty.
Smells so good. Oh my God. Then Javier texts and is like, you guys want to come to La Cava, have just a little afternoon drink?
Yes, 100%.
And I start running. So yeah, he was drunk twice during the day, and I again stone cold sober. Okay.
All right. Anyway, so we did actually agree on a couple of things.
Okay. The thing that we both absolutely loved, and this was not like a no for me, but sort of like meh last year, was the orange blossom saffron cake at Tangerine Cafe in Morocco. Okay. It's not new, but it is. Improved, and let me tell you why. Now, I know I am a sucker for a sauce. I love a saucier. Those are my favorite people in the kitchen. I think they're always overlooked. because if the sauce is junk, it doesn't matter how great anything else is. And if the sauce is lovely, count me in, because now I don't taste the other junk underneath. Okay. So the raspberry sauce is more plentiful. It is thicker than last year and it's better. So it's a little less like, you know, that puckery, I'm pointing under my ear, that piquant like tartness, less of that, a little more sweet, but not too sweet. Oh, so good. And the cake is thicker, the pistachio cake and the pistachio brittle that is served with it.
And this was $5, right?
Mm-hmm. I believe it was. Yeah, $5.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought this was one of the best things that I had too. I thought
hands down.
All of the flavors you could taste individually. It was, first of all, it looks very pretty. It was attractive. Gorgeous. It was well presented well. I thought the flavors were very interesting on it. The cake was the sponge itself was excellent. Every time you ate it, you had a slightly different flavor. And you're right. I mean, the raspberry jam was the thing that made it. Yeah, I liked this quite a bit.
It was wonderful. Okay. Then I have never once ever said go get veal, because I don't know why. I just don't. But the veal at Farmer's Feast for $8.50, she's a little pricey. Use a snack credit. Mm-hmm. Why is this like the best thing? I don't know if it was the peas, the mushed peas. Anglophile. Yeah. I don't know. It was bright. It was gorgeous. It was filling. It was like a whole family size meal. Like, you'll be done.
At $8.50, you think it's more like an entree at that size?
Yes, absolutely. I loved it. And then the last thing not to skip is brunch cot. The avocado toast every year. It is so hard to get avocado balanced with whatever citrus you use, whether it's lemon or, you know, lime or whatever you're using. But I don't know how they get it exactly right. And it's, it's so good. And then the watermelon radish, which I love.
Watermelon radish is a garnish on the avocado toast. I didn't have it with you, but I had it on that day towards the end of the day. So when I'd actually like already sort of been through 20 different flavors, and I thought this was a highlight as well.
Yeah. And you were soberish at that point.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely. Close. It's always good. It's always pretty. I went back and did like a little, hey, here's these dishes that have been here for at least 4 years and how they've changed over the years. And that's one of the ones that the serving size has maybe gotten a little bit bigger even. And it's not expensive. What is it? $6.
Yeah. It was a generous slice of avocado toast. The other thing I was surprised with, how do they get the avocado not to turn brown? Like, it was still bright green.
Well, that's what the acid is. And then you have to keep when you make avocado at home, you put the saran wrap directly on top of it. Like you do a pudding. Yep. It doesn't turn brown, doesn't oxidize or whatever. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Okay, cool.
But it is a heavy like acid, like a citrus something in there, so it wouldn't turn. Okay, so stuff to skip. France is a whole brown booth. Mm-hmm. It's all like, I understand they love their bread. I skip.
Yeah.
And then anything impossible. If it's impossible, it shouldn't be done.
You want to talk about surprises for this year? I thought that the vegan options were far less tasty and interesting this year than any previous year. Yeah.
I would go back to a cauliflower steak or jackfruit. What did we do? Jackfruit 1 year, 100 times?
And some of the, like, I had the plant-based meatball.
Ugh.
And it had a very strong lentil taste to it, but like,
which I love, but it's the chemical.
But it was a chemical. It was like a chemical lentil flavor, and that's
not
the thing.
Cute
it was like
at all.
Yeah,
nope. And this you need the tongue scraper after that one. That was
nothing other than the plant based buffalo chicken and tots. That was the one exception to this rule. But of all of the other impossible and vegan things we tasted, none of them tasted right this year.
Huge difference between the plant-based and the impossible. I will agree with you on the buffalo sauce. You know what it's like? It's like the 1990s original Hooters sauce. That really strong vinegar, lovely.
Yeah, I'm okay with that. I kind of like
it. I would buy the bottle, bottle of that sauce. It's lovely. Okay, anyway. Yeah, absolutely no impossible stuff. And whatever on earth they put in that steam bun in Japan is foul. It was not good. It was offensive.
I'm with you on that.
And then, of course, they have the frushi again.
Yeah.
The other thing to skip is the crab wontons in China. In China, they're like,
I mean, just, I automatically go past China now. And in Italy, we actually went to Italy and ate just to say we did it. It's kind of like, Jim,
yeah,
this
we
is
can't
kind of
show
like,
everybody what you did, but you had the best review of Italy.
And okay. So, Jim, this is the question that I had for Chrissy. Like, how do you take a group of Italians and crush their spirit so much that they don't care about the food quality that they're serving? Like I told Chrissy, like when I was reviewing it, and I apologize, this is a podcast, but I'm going to make you guys imagine something for a second. You know how, Jim, that there's this Italian gesture where you put your fingertips on your neck and you stroke it up past your chin in order to say, like, get out of here. Right. Right.
Yep.
You're familiar with this. Imagine that as a flavor. That's what eating in Italy is like these days. It's like, if you could do that gesture,
But then
you
gotta
sauce.
Pay for it too.
Yeah. How do you get Italians to not care about food? It's remarkable. Like, it's just,
you're thinking about it all wrong. They're all gorgeous. They don't eat anyway. Did you see them? They're all stunning.
Oh no, they're all impossibly thin and beautiful and, you know,
fabulous looking. They don't care about your stupid American taste buds.
But I mean, just think from a sense of national pride, they're like, you know,
you're an Epcot.
Okay. All right. Fair.
That four cheese, the fact that it separated before we walked.
That's
from
right. It had turned grainy in the time from the time we ordered to the time we picked it up. And the other thing too was everything was cold.
It was even before getting the and the cannoli.
How do you get Italians to not care about food? I don't know.
The cannoli is boxed wine. You know, just.
Yes,
you want the good stuff. So, all right.
I don't know.
Yeah. All right. I know that's not a shocker, but there are a lot of really, really great things, and there's something to see everywhere, and all the little topiaries and everything. And then, hello, Modern English is coming next week. I will be at all six shows.
That's right, because our mutual sister Linda is a huge Modern English fan.
Who isn't? So,
I listened to them this morning. So,
bands. I'm surprised you didn't go see Tiffany the other night. I know your secret obsession. Yeah.
I'm heading over tonight, so we'll see who's there.
Yeah. Okay. Garden Rocks is
all right,
definitely
thanks,
the best for old folks.
All right, Chrissy, thanks very much for being on the show. Where can people find more of you?
Touring Plans, Instagram.
@TouringPlans on Instagram.
Yeah, that's it.
And we'll see you around the parks. I think I'm headed to either Epcot or the studios tonight. So if you're around, let me know.
Okay. Thank you, Jim.
All right, Jim, we should move on now to listener questions. We've got quite a few of them. Here we go. Here's one from Evan, who says, I want to let you know that I went to Marceline today, and my trip was inspired by the most recent episode of the Disney Dish. I'm currently moving from Portland, Oregon to Knoxville by way of a massive road trip, and I'm driving through Wyoming yesterday listening to the show, and one of you just happened to mention Marceline, and I looked up how reasonable it would be to add this pit stop, and it wasn't too far of the way. I had the best time. I was a Walt Disney World cast member for 6 years and have been a lifelong Disney fan, so this was a bucket list item for me. If it had not been for all the recent Autopia information, I would not have appreciated the significance of the midget Autopia. And Jim, have you been there?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Nancy and I, last June, kind of the same thing. Nancy had a Hallmark convention, I want to say that.
Oh, you said, yeah.
Yeah, Kansas City, and our host, suggested, look, you're that far. Marceline is just sort of a teeny bit out of your way. And it was, again, same thing like Evan. It was a bucket list thing. I've been meaning to get there for years, and it was so much fun. And as he mentioned, they have restored the Midget Autopia track in town, so you can go to see where it was after it left Disneyland.
Yeah, and Evan says it was fascinating to see the site of the old track and one of the cars. Also, just want to thank you for making my road trip much more memorable. I love listening to the show, and I love binging the Patreon content. Oh, fantastic. Very nice. Glad that worked out, Evan. Safe travels. All right, Jim, this one's for you. It's from Joshua, and he says, do you know why Disney still has the Monster University blue hats for sale in the parks? The movie came out in 2013 and wasn't hugely popular, but they continue to sell them in the parks. I have a theory, and that's that when the person who placed the order for the hats ordered them, they accidentally added an extra zero when ordering and have way more hats than they wanted to. Good theory, Joshua. But Jim, what's the reasoning here?
Well, I love that theory as well. But the reality is the Monsters at Work animated series, which debuted on Disney Plus July of 2021. And by the way, second season of that show debuts in just a couple of weeks on the Disney Channel, April 5th. And then that continues as available on Disney Plus starting on May 5th. But just a quick aside here. First season of the show was developed by Bob's Ganaway, who did the Buzz Lightyear of Star Command show. What's interesting, second season of the show, that's actually being done by Kevin Dieters and Stevie Werner's Skelton. These are the two lovely people who did the two Prep and Landing holiday specials, as well as the Olaf Christmas special, which again, tradition here in the house. You can't let the holidays in go without listening to Josh Gad sing That Time of Year.
It's a new tradition. It's like Mariah Carey, right?
There we go.
You know, my theory on this is that, especially during spring break, kids are coming down, they have off from school, and if you're a high school student or you're a college student, there is kind of an appeal to saying you go to Monsters University, right?
You're not wrong.
I kind of get that.
I kind of immediately see the appeal. Wow. Okay.
I'm waiting for someone on, when they announce, when they show during NFL football games, the player, and they announce where they're from. I need like a huge defensive lineman somewhere to say, Ignacio Cuatres, Monsters University. Like, I think that would be great. All right. Here's an email from Sybil. And Jim, as a native English speaker, I'd like your help with this one. Sybil writes, I have a trip to Epcot for Flower and Garden Festival coming up next month and have a burning question. What is the pronunciation of the name of the main quick service restaurant in Morocco? In my mind, I pronounce it like the city of Tangier with an E at the end. Tangerian rhymes with Nigerian, but I've heard it pronounced like the citrus fruit. Mediterranean flatbread and pomegranate mimosas are clearly calling my name. Thanks for the podcast. I never miss an episode. And so I responded to Sybil, Jim, with this note to start. Thank God someone is finally asking the important questions here. So the city is Tangier, right? So it would make sense that it is Tangerian. And that's how I think it should be pronounced. But what do you think?
I think, sadly, I will tell you what I call it. That place that keeps changing, the restaurant that doesn't succeed. Let's go there. The place that has the views of the show that also keeps changing. All right, it's like
place with the flatbread.
Place with the flatbread.
Okay. That is a third option that I hadn't considered. All right, but I really think it's Tangerian. And if you wanted to say it Tangerine, I would say it's Tangerian, like that. But I think Tangerine is the easiest way to say.
Anytime saying a restaurant name physically hurts you, that's not good, Len.
it's funny because I have to sort of like stretch my jaw muscles to say it the right way.
Yeah.
You know what? It's fine. It's a little exercise. It's fine. All right. On last week's show, we mentioned that two groups of students at Wake Forest University are looking at ride wait times and downtime at Rope Drop to figure out what are the best two attractions for you to try and visit at Hollywood Studios if you don't know whether any rides are working during early theme park entry. And Aaron wrote in with this. Listening to your latest episode, I can't wait for your data on ride downtime. On ride downtime versus early entry. Thanks for this. On our last trip, both Seven Dwarfs Mine Train and Space Mountain were down for early entry. By the time we realized this and went to Peter Pan, so had the rest of the crowd. So we were then faced with the choice of waiting at the rope to Frontierland to try to get to Big Thunder Mountain, or wait to see if Mine Train or Space Mountain would open. It was the most stressful morning of the trip and also the most deflating. We had got 12 people up into the park to just wait. So it's interesting because I got a ton of emails like this from Aaron's people who said, I got to the park, super early. We got the kids out of bed. It was a struggle, but we got to the park before early theme park entry opened. And then we waited in line for a ride that didn't open, right? So the interesting thing is, the same day that I was in Epcot with Chrissy, before I started drinking, so the thing started at 10 o'clock. At 9:30, I had an interim call with the kids for them to go over what they found so far. And so I've seen the preliminary results, and they're really interesting because once you know the reason for the results, it makes absolute sense. So as soon as they're done, maybe we'll have the kids on and they'll go over it. But like they've discovered something that helps. And we'll let them talk about it. Also, on last week's show, we asked listeners what Disney could possibly offer Universal to give up Universal's East of the Mississippi exclusive rights to the Marvel characters. And Kelly wrote in with some great ideas. And she says, there's a word that often gets left out in these discussions, and ours was no exception. And that word is, quote, exclusive. It's a very different question to ask if Universal would allow Disney to also build attractions featuring characters such as Spider-Man or the Incredible Hulk than it is to ask what it would cost for Comcast to relinquish the rights entirely and rip out an entire land from one of their most important theme parks. So what if Universal says you can build your Dark Phoenix coaster and your weird Spider-Man shooty game in Florida? These are, by the way, all Kelly's characterizations, which I love. But we're not restricted from continuing to use them. So the question is what would Universal want in return? Any ideas?
I've jumped ahead to what Kelly, I think Kelly's on to something about, you know, what it would actually take.
So Kelly mentions, what about the X-Files? It might be an enticing evergreen property for Disney and Fox to trade. Universal's never needed the Marvel IP to be ultra valuable for it to be useful in their Florida theme parks. But does Disney think it's needed? And if so, why? That's a great question.
It is. And what's kind of interesting, just in the past week or so, I was reading something to the effect of, you know, face it, UFOs have been in the news for the past
year. Right, yeah.
And yeah. There's been a suggestion that, again, Disney, who is desperate to get more value out of the $69 billion they paid for Fox, the notion of, should we look at reviving the X-Files? And evidently somebody reached out to David Duchovny, who kind of demurred, you know, about talking about it, suggested this might actually be in the works.
Fascinating. Huh. Because if they could link that somehow, like if the Simpsons Springfield Land goes away, the thing adjacent to that is Men in Black, which is, not for nothing, alien themed. We could do an entire alien themed land. Anyway, my show notes here indicated the following thing. A, this is the smartest take, Kelly, I've heard on this topic, and I want you to negotiate everything we ever need going forward, because you've clearly thought this through from more angles than anyone, and you're looking for win-wins, which is the way to do negotiations. So, yeah, Kelly's smarter than the rest of us. All right, the other thing we talked about last week was Disney's 2025 offer of free water park admission on check-in days for Disney Resort guests. And Jim, the number of emails we got on this was just astounding. Most people were trying to figure out how to game the system, and God bless all of you, because it is the most entertaining set of emails I read all week. But our friend Rick writes in with this. He says, could Disney's free water park, in quotes, perk, be at least partially intended to draw one day of split-stay dollars away from Universal? I'm assuming the number of people committing vacation time to Universal is going to go up next year because of Epic Universe. That's a safe bet. Maybe instead of spending your Universal check-in, check-out day at Volcano Bay, because it's right there and it's the same as Disney's parks, this entices people to move over to Disney property earlier in the day where they'd spend money on lunch, souvenirs, towels, and so on. Not a bad idea. Okay, not a bad. So take people away from Volcano Bay into your Disney theme park. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that as a strategy, sort of like chipping around the edges of Universal's advantage, but okay, that makes total sense. All right, and then Nick adds these thoughts. He says, do you think this could impact how people book their accommodations? Instead of booking the first day, a travel day, on property, book off property and have your second day at the water park. Could Disney actually lose booking nights with this promotion? I've already thought about this for our next day, which is why I wrote in. And I wrote to Nick and I was like, Nick, bad. This is exactly the wrong thing that Disney wants you to think. So don't do that.
Well, a quick aside here. Derek Bergen has just did a piece for Touring Plans, the Saturday Six, about staying at Volcano Bay the hotel that's right.
Cabana Bay.
Cabana Bay. All right.
Yeah. But he had his whole family there.
Yeah,
it was great.
Yeah. But what was intriguing about, and again, just to give you some idea of how Universal Parks and Experiences is playing the long game, when Derek noted that when Cabana Bay opened, that out ahead, they mentioned that the price point for this hotel, and remember, this was 2014 when this first opened, was $174 a night. Now, Derek noted that on his most recent visit, when he went to go book, you know, a room at this hotel 10 years later, Len, it still had the $174 a night price point. And, you know, and the interesting thing is I had been flat out told, for example, for the Endless Summer hotel that they built out on, there we go. Universal had committed to the idea of, look, we will operate this thing at a loss for 7 years. With the
I remember you saying this because they actually had to tell, or they went out and told the neighboring hotels, this is our strategy. Please adjust.
Yeah, no, that's it exactly. That we are going to be here at this price point, and if you want any business, you're going to have to, you know, sort of reflect what the market will bear in this neighborhood.
Well, it did cause a number of hotels to remodel. Like they're like, okay, well, you know, in order for us to make the same amount of money, we need to improve the quality of our room so that people aren't just defaulting to Universal.
Okay, I will say this much, that, you know, during my time staying at Endless Summer a year or so ago, it didn't just force other hotels around it to lower its price point. Some of them closed flat out.
Some of them closed, yeah,
they
exactly.
They could not compete. So
no, they just decided that, spending millions of dollars on renovations and then having to compete on price and service when you're offsite, that's just not the land is probably more valuable than that investment.
Absolutely. So. But again, you know, just the whole notion that, you know, I think that's the other thing with Disney, which seems to live from, you know, well, what do we need to say for this quarter's earnings statement? Whereas Universal has been in the long game for so much longer, you know, decades. It's interesting to watch Disney now trying to figure out, well, how do we deal with that? And it's like, I don't think you can.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough situation. So the other thing I wanted to mention is the most common email that I got. And so thanks to Dan, to Valerie, to Francine, and to Morgan, who all wrote in with some variation of this. And they said, in looking at Disney hotel and water park prices for 2025, a family of four, two adults, two kids, would spend right now around $303 for 1 day of Disney water park admission. But has Disney considered that it's much less expensive with this new deal to book a throwaway room at Fort Wilderness campsites for $103, saving $200 and sleeps 10 people? Or you could book any of the All-Star resorts for $132, saving $171, or Pop Century for $184, saving $120. So what they're saying here is it's actually cheaper to book the hotel room and not use it instead of buying water park tickets. So, Jim, is Disney trying to boost hotel occupancy by decreasing revenue? It seems like the exact opposite of they normally operate. So is this something that they've just not yet gamed out? I mean, this seems like a pretty clear workaround to save a lot of money.
Absolutely. But do we know the specific terms and conditions of
read them. So it's interesting because the blog post says, we're going to have more to say about this in 2024, but you can book them now. You can book these rooms now. So my sense is, and again, not a lawyer, right? But if I book this offer now and there are no other restrictions in place, that's a contract. That's the deal I get. Why would I not just book campsites, never use the campsite, save the $200 and go to the water park?
Okay. Gonna be an interesting summer, Len.
My sense is that some of these rules are going to be like, you know, they'll probably exclude the campsites. It'll probably be a two-night minimum. But even then, I mean, the All-Stars would still be $264 with tax. It'd still be cheaper for two nights at the All-Star. Anyway, super interesting, and I love that that our listeners' immediate thought was, how do I game this system? So love it.
You gotta love bright listeners.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, Jim looks ahead to the Magic Kingdom's Beyond Big Thunder project and walks us through part of the last huge Magic Kingdom transformation project when Disney proposed Pixie Hollow for Fantasyland, and we ended up with Storybook Circus. We'll be right back. And we're back. Jim, I'm super excited about this because since Bob Iger said yesterday that Disney parks around the world have plenty of room to add at least one new land in each park. Yeah. And my initial response was, I think the way he said it was, they could build one more land in every park around the world. And my immediate response was, if my grandmother had wheels, she could be a bicycle. But I'm not sure that that's the response that the Disney Corporation was looking. So why don't you walk us through this?
Okay. Well, face it, Iger is talking this way because, as we mentioned earlier, you know, we do have Epic Universe looming. And remember, every time our buddy BioReconstruct does a flyover of that construction site, what's interesting is we see the same thing happen over and over again online. First, everyone sings Bio's praises, as they should, for the latest spectacular set of photos. But then invariably we get the whole Disney fan saying, why doesn't Disney build something like this? And the answer to Len is they are. They're just not here in the States. Not yet, anyway. And case in point, Fantasy Springs at Tokyo Disney Seas in Japan. This project, in one form or another, has been in the works since 2015. And back then, on the heels of the huge international success of the first Frozen movie, which was released in theaters in November 2013, that Academy Award-winning film earned $1.3 billion of it worldwide, with, Len, a quarter of a billion of that, $249 million, just coming from ticket sales in Japan. So the people of Japan love them some Frozen. Okay, so anyway, on the heels of that success, the Oriental Land Company announces plans to add a Scandinavian port to Tokyo Disney Seas. And Len, by the way, you and I have seen this model. You remember last year when we went with Jim Shula, did that walkthrough of Imagineering, and they took us into the model shop?
Oh, yeah. And they showed us a ride vehicle, right?
Well, that was the interesting.
Model. No, it was the model itself. It was the land itself.
Well, that's the interesting. To the left, we had the ride vehicle for the Tangled ride.
And Shul said he'd worked on that.
But to the right was this elaborate model for Arendelle as a port at Tokyo Disney Sea. Now where this got complicated is November of 2016, Hong Kong announced that it would be adding a World of Frozen to that theme park and a Stark Expo and a Castle of Magical Dreams and multiple other attractions. And Len, I'm not saying these two Asian Disney theme parks compete, well, and they're resorts, really. But in June of 2018, the Oriental Land Company said, did we say we were adding a single Scandinavian port to Tokyo Disney Sea? Our mistake.
My bad.
You know, so what we're actually building is the largest addition ever to our second gate. 40 square acres, includes a Frozen-themed land, a Rapunzel-themed land, a Peter Pan-themed land, and our sixth on-site hotel. So anyway, construction gets underway May of 2019. Oriental Land Company announces that they'll have this open by 2023, which I'm sure has nothing to do with Hong Kong Disneyland's World of Frozen, supposedly opening in November of that same year.
Total coincidence.
Total coincidence.
Oh my God. I need to manage my calendar better. I'm so sorry.
But then the pandemic happens, and which is why October of 2022, Oriental Land Company has to say, look, opening day is slid till spring of 2024. And in fact, just a couple of weeks ago, they locked it in. It's June 6th of this year. Now, for today's show, we're going to concentrate on just one part of Fantasy Springs project, Peter Pan's Neverland. And in fact, we're going to focus in on one specific aspect of this land, which is the kid-friendly attraction Fairy Tinkerbell's Busy Buggies. And yes, Len, that is the real name for this ride for families with smaller kids. Fairy Tinkerbell's Busy Buggies. And
so is there another Tinkerbell that isn't a fairy?
I was looking for a reason, and I think I found it in the official description of this attraction. It mentions how once you enter the queue, everything from flowers to mushrooms to painting utensils to pieces of nibbled cheese will appear bigger in size, and, you know, leading guests to realize they have shrunk down to the size of a fairy and entered their world. So you get it, Len? You're small now, like a fairy, okay?
Am I small like a rat in a Parisian restaurant? Or am I small like an audience who's been shrunk by some kind of ray? Is it like that? Is that the premise?
I believe the phrase you're looking for in the French restaurant is petite, Len.
Petite. And, it'd also be, could this also be considered an adventure through some sort of inner space? Okay. All right. Go ahead. Just making sure that I've never heard of this concept before.
All right.
Go ahead.
But here's the other thing, Len. Okay. So the premise of this attraction, again, the Fairy Tinkerbell's Busy Buggies, is once you climb inside your vehicle, you are now effectively an employee of the Amazon warehouse that services Neverland. I mean, seriously.
halfway through the ride, are you supposed to unionize? Like, what's I'm trying to figure out. You're dodging robots.
No, I mean,
the CEO is posting strange stuff online all the time, and you got to deal with that, and then you got to unionize. Like, what?
Okay, all right. Well, no, seriously, this is how the ride is described. Guests help Tinkerbell as she starts her new delivery service in Pixie Hollow while visiting four seasonal locations to deliver various packages and parcels to the fairies.
Oh my God, she's a drone. Okay, all right, got it. Okay, all right. Now it all makes sense. Go ahead.
All right, now, just to be clear here, if you do, in fact, join the staff of Busy Buggies, be sure and take out your phone and take a picture of each package, because Neverland doesn't have Porch Pilot. It has real pirates.
All right. Okay. All right.
Now, speaking of which, I want to take a sec here to talk about the marquee attraction for Peter Pan's Neverland, which is called Peter Pan's Neverland Adventure. Not the subtlest name, Len. Sort of like going to a fast food restaurant and saying, I'll have the cheeseburger burger. But, all right, anyway, what's kind of interesting about Peter Pan's Neverland Adventure, 6-minute long ride through that involves animation, 3D glasses, but this time around, you're not rescuing Wendy or Tiger Lily from Captain Hook and his crew, but rather Wendy's brother John, the middle child of the Darling family, the one with the top.
It's always the middle. Yeah, it's always the middle.
Yeah,
kid.
Yeah, well, I say that as the middle kid, Len.
Me too.
Okay,
me too.
But I kind of like this message, you know, because it's like, you know, look, boys need rescuing sometimes too, and more to the point, you know, young ladies can and should get in on the action.
That's a great message. All right, cool. Okay, good.
Okay, so anyway, back to Fairy Tinkerbell's Busy Buggies, which, by the way, our friend Mr. Schull described as kind of a glorified version of, what is it, the Heimlich's choo-choo train that used to be in A Bug's Land at California Adventure, only kind of supersized. All right, now, what's kind of interesting, I want to circle back to the Oriental Land Company's official description of this Fantasy Springs attraction, again, for families with smaller children, and it says, guests can help Tinkerbell as she starts her delivery service in Pixie Hollow. Now, that is a name that Disney World should remember. Okay, because once upon a time, the Magic Kingdom in Florida was slated to have, its very own Pixie Hollow as part of the new Fantasyland expansion project for that park.
All right, Jim, real quick on this. So I'm not super familiar with Tinkerbell lore. Is Pixie Hollow an original name that Disney came up with in this century for that land, or is Pixie Hollow always been canonically associated with?
All right. It's the former, not the latter.
Really?
Yeah. That if we go, if we go back to the original Peter Pan books and plays, I mean, you know, Tinkerbell is effectively, you know, I mean, glued to Peter Pan's side. At no time does, you know, well, I have to get home. I got to check the mail. I got to take the dog out and walk it. You know, I should go home to Pixie Hollow. But anyway, getting back to the origins of this project, the new Fantasyland project, announced in September 2009, Jay Rizzullo, the then chairman of Disney Park. Yeah, Len, you know,
I know where you're going with this, and legally I cannot comment.
Okay, but no, this is where it, you know, again, I am fascinated how, you know, so often when you are covering the Disney company, it is a snake that eats its own tail. I mean, Jay Rizzullo, if you've been following what's been going on the corporate side of things, folks, you've heard Jay Rizzullo's name. He's a candidate that Nelson Peltz has nominated for a seat on the Disney's board of directors. And it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out at the shareholders meeting, which, by the way, Len, being held virtually on Wednesday, April 3rd.
I'm not going to comment.
On advice of counsel. There we go. Now, when the new Fantasyland project was first announced nearly 15 years ago, it called for the near doubling of size of the most popular land at the Magic Kingdom, going from 10 acres to 21 acres. And what Rizzullo originally wanted to add to Florida's Fantasyland was a place where guests, and quoting from the official press release now, could meet Tinkerbell and her friends in the magical world of Pixie Hollow. Now, Pixie Hollow came out of the Disney Fairies effort, which was launched in 2005, some 4 years before the Pixie Hollow project got announced. And Disney Fairies, well, the creation of this franchise was spurred by a couple of things. First and foremost was the launch of the Disney Princess franchise in late 99, early 2000, and the enormous success of that bit of branding. Len, it started in its first official year with $300 million worth of sales in 2001.
And that's when steak was a nickel, too. So, I mean, we're talking about real money.
Yeah. And by 2012, it was a $3 billion a year industry or a division of the company. Now, problem, though, Len, is Disney Princess, with Disney Princess, is that kids would age out of this franchise. All right. The typical user was between 5 to 7 years old. And what Disney Fairies allowed Disney to do was effectively give Disney Princess fans a new franchise to graduate into. And in fact, what's so interesting, earlier in the show, Chrissy was making a joke about journaling and that sort of thing. That was actually a huge component of Disney Fairies. They were supported by a line of books and the notion of, fairies are very much into creating things and here, let us sell you a journal for $15. But again, the Disney Fairies customer typically was 7 to 9 years old. So in fairy, you could grab young girls from 5 to 9 and hang on to them if you sort of slotted these two franchises back to back. And
okay, so age 5, age 6, age 7, age 8, age 9. Jim, that's I also note that if Disney's trying to get people to visit the parks every 5 years, you could potentially have two visits on either side of that at your age 5 and age 9. It makes sense from a data perspective.
Well, and speaking of data, the other thing that drove Disney's decision to create Disney Fairies things is they had this weird stat come out of Disneyland. In fact, this is supposedly the spark that launched this whole thing. That they wanted info out of Anaheim. What's your number one selling character? And it's like, well, duh, it's Mickey. But number two is Tinkerbell. And it was just, and in fact, what was fascinating is every night after the fireworks happened, everyone would walk down Main Street, and a good chunk of them would duck into the Emporium. And they said that 80% of Tinkerbell sales per day happened in those 2 hours after the fireworks. People went in, had just seen her jump off, the Matterhorn.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so okay,
that makes sense.
Character front of mind, that's what they want.
I'm moderately surprised that Disney management did not look at that and say, what other characters can we push off of buildings? isn't that the way that you think Bob Chapek would think in your heart of hearts, Jim? In your heart of hearts.
Yeah. Okay.
Why have I not thought of this line before then?
Wow.
Oh my God.
Wow. It's the whole notion, call the warehouse. How much plush are we sitting on? Okay. You put Bing Bong up on the Matterhorn and push him off. Okay. Anyway. Okay. So, but here's the other thing that you'll appreciate this. Before they committed to building Pixie Hollow, they wanted a proof of concept. So October of 2004, they launched a trial balloon. They literally pushed Goofy, Pluto, and Donald out of their meet and greet spot at County Fair in Mickey's Toontown. And they put Tinkerbell and her Pixie Pals in there. And that day and for the next week, they had 2 to 3 hour long lines. They put a placard up at the front of the park announcing Disney Fairies back there. And And the thinking was, the Imagineers looked at the data, they showed it to the entertainment staff, and it's like, look, if we set up a Disney fairies theme thing toward the back of the park here, in you know, when we do this new Fantasyland project, and we have to redo Mickey's Toontown Fair as part of it, here's the reality. You know, every little girl who comes to Orlando to go to Walt Disney World is going to spend hours back here. You know, they will go to the Disney princesses, then they will go to Disney fairies. More to the point, on their way out of the park, they will have to walk past every shop and restaurant from the very back of the park.
It's true. You have to go through like at least half.
Yeah.
No matter how you get there. Oh my God, that's amazing.
So that was the thing. That's like, we will make money hand over fist. We have to do this. And in fact, it was such a can't miss, sure to succeed proposition that even as the Imagineers are designing a Pixie Hollow for Florida, they are also designing a Pixie Hollow for the new castle park that they are going to build in Shanghai. So, I mean, that's how certain they were that this was going to be an enormous success. So how do we go from two Pixie Hollows being planned to the singular Fairy Tinkerbell's Busy Buggies that will be opening at Tokyo DisneySea in June? Len, we will get to that in the second and final installment of the series, which we will do on next week's show.
Oh, fantastic. I remember where I was when news dropped about the changes to New Fantasyland. And I was on the phone with you, but I remember like it was yesterday, like where I was, how we had that conversation, and what we thought was going on. So super excited, looking forward to that.
Okay, no, it's a great story. And more to the point, I mean, Disney Fairies still exists, you know, as a thing, but certainly not, you know, Disney princess size. But again, we'll get to that next week.
The thing that I remember, not to spoil next week's show, but I remember, but even before Disney's announcement, you were saying, no, this whole thing's dead. Mm. Like they're going in a completely different direction. So, all right, we'll talk about it next week.
Okay.
All right, folks, that's going to do it for the show today. You can help support our show by subscribing over at patreon.com/Jim Hill Media, where we're posting exclusive shows every week. Check it out at patreon.com/Jim Hill Media. On next week's show, we finish up the story of how we went from multiple Pixie Hollows to one. You can find more of Jim at jimhillmedia.com and more of me, Len, at touringplans.com. We're produced spectacularly by Eric Hersey, who'll be sharing Grandma Hersey's maple flapjack recipe and more at this weekend's Maryland Maple Syrup Festival, March 16th and 17th, 2024, at the Cunningham Falls State Park on Catoctin Hollow Road in beautiful Thurmont, Maryland. While Eric's doing that, please go into iTunes and rate our show and tell us what you'd like to hear next. For Jim and Chrissy, this is Len. We will see you on the next show.